Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Tacconi, Artistic Director of Berkeley Rep. How many years now?
It's 15 years as Artistic Director and 25 years at Berkeley Rep, which I guess many of my audience members would say is far too long.
On the other hand, it means that there's a continuity of style, mm-hmm. a thematic continuity, which you can use to grow on what you've done in the past.
The great advantage of being in a job like this for a long time is that you are involved in an ongoing conversation with both yourself and your staff and your board, of course, but also with the audience. And I think that the great gift of Berkeley Rep to me is that our audience has remained open to the changes and the growing ambitions that we've had, certainly with the amount of new work that we're doing. The audience has come along for the ride. Not everybody, of course, but the numbers of people who have decided to stay with us over a very long period of time, all the way back to College Avenue, is astonishingly high.
Well, one thing I've noticed, and this is true for you, for ACT, and the Magic now focuses almost exclusively on new work. Why does there seem to be more of an emphasis on new work in 2012, a growing emphasis, than in the past? What do you think that's about?
Well, for us, I mean, certainly, you know, the Magic has always done new plays. I think for Berkeley Rep, I think we were weaned on the traditional regional theater menu of classical plays, mostly from the European canon. Wonderful, wonderful plays. And I think we do still produce classical plays because I think that you always want to measure yourself up against, you know, the greatest plays of all time. So I think that there's a good reason to continue to do classical work. For us, however, I started to feel about 15 years ago for myself, I started to ask myself, what's the greatest contribution we can make to the field? And I felt like there was a plethora of theaters, ACT, Cal Shakes, San Francisco Shakespeare Festival, that were, you know, dedicated entirely towards doing classical work. And the field felt crowded, and I also felt that intuitively with our staff and who we were, where we were, geographically who we are, that new ideas was something that felt like it was a good match for us. And then I think that my own background, Les Waters' background, who was my associate for many years, you know, was in growing up in the 60s, in the heyday of a kind of, you know, this sort of fervent scrutiny of society, and what better way to sort of engage in a dialogue about that artistically, if not through new work.
And your audience is willing to come along with this, I guess. Do you get any feedback on that element?
Oh, Richard. I should come by and, you know, have a peek at my scrapbook at some point. And, you know, I get letters a lot, the critical variety. I also get a lot of really, you know, supportive mail. But certainly there have been many people who've taken umbrage with this play or that play. I mean, some plays are upsetting to people for a wide variety of reasons. But in general, a play crosses somebody's boundary. I think frequently people didn't even know they had the boundary until they saw the play, and they were like, that's crossing my boundary. That's either, you know, and there's all kinds of reasons, from the more typical ones that where, you know, there's smoking on stage, which is a, you know, like a big thing for a lot of folks, to, you know, this play was horrible. How could you possibly do this play? This play was not up to your standards. It usually starts with, I've been coming to Berkeley Rep for 30 years, and never in all that time have I seen something this bad. But, you know, you have to take that. I mean, it's part of the job, and you try to listen to it. Even when you're in violent disagreement with, you know, with somebody, you have to respect what their feeling is and what their opinion is. But that's probably why, for me, the way we produce, because we're taking more risks, the way that we produce the plays has to be almost unimpeachable. The level of craft that we have to exhibit for every show has got to be high enough so that somebody can say, you know, I didn't like the play, but they did it well.
Carrie Perloff said that one way for her to deal with this sort of issue is to understand that theater itself should get you thinking, however it gets you thinking. So the controversy on some level is good because you are focusing on the play.
Yeah, I mean, obviously somebody who's motivated enough to write an impassioned letter of response is coming from a place where they're motivated. They care enough to write the letter to express an opinion. I think you're absolutely right. What Carrie said is that, you know, it's endemic to the art form that we are going to ask you to reflect and to consider and to argue with the content of the play. You go to see other performing arts, you know, dance or, you know, anything nonverbal, has this sort of what I would call the comfort zone of not dealing that much with content, whereas every single play we do deals with content and is potentially controversial.
And the latest play, the one running through June 24th, is Black and Blue Boys Broken Men, a one-woman show by Dale Orlandersmith, and that is about abuse of men.
Yeah, it's a controversial topic in the sense that nobody talks about it much, and Dale was motivated by her experience as a social worker when she was first joining the workforce to create this astonishing portrait of men basically from the underclass, you know, who haven't had voice about this topic before, and her depictions are arduously truthful and bold, and they're full of suffering. And one of the things about the play that I love is that it is anti-romantic. And, you know, look, Richard, we live in pretty dark times, so people's capacity to embrace darkness on stage is limited. But when I watched the show in rehearsal hall for the first time, I was struck by how much we've all become in need of, if not addicted to, this idea of romance, that art should provide us some release from all the darkness. And I think that's dangerous. It's dangerous to always be looking for that. And so I'm really proud of the play, and I'm really proud of Dale for having the sort of guts, you know, to go to this place and create portraits of guys who don't have a lot of options. And her ability as a performer, just she's an astonishing actress. I mean, rhythmically and musically and emotionally and intellectually, she's able to kind of create. I mean, you're there with these guys, and I think it's really exciting to watch her do the work.
How did you find this particular piece?
Dale's an old friend, and you know, there are a number of artists. There are probably like 300 or 400 artists who we keep in constant contact with, just wanting to know what it is that they're working on, what new project they have going, and she's one of them.
The several areas I cover in our yearly discussion, the coming season, the past season, plus what Berkeley Rep is doing now. But I want to hit one point. Mike Daisy, the story of Mike Daisy.
Yes.
Now, he was here at Berkeley Rep. We were all blown away. He was on KPFA. A few months ago, when he was still at the Public, Catherine Boo, who wrote this amazing book about Mumbai Undercity, was talking to me. She was wondering if her reportorial work can change the world. I mentioned Mike Daisy as an example, and then 2 weeks later it all exploded.
Right.
What's your take on this, and how do you view Daisy today?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Mike made some pretty egregious mistakes. I mean, there's two categories of mistakes he made. One is he embellished his story because it was a better story. It's better if the stuff happened to him, right? So the stuff happened. The events that he describes happened. Not all of them happened to him. That's one area of fabrication that I think was a mistake. I regard that as a relatively minor sin in relation to his other much larger crime, in that when he left the stage, when he walked off stage, he was no longer an actor, no longer telling us a story from the arena of the stage, which has built-in latitude. It has built-in flexibility. There's a more blurry line there. But when he went off stage and told reporters, as journalists, when he repeated this story de facto as having happened to him, I think then he entered into a much more dangerous territory. And I've spoken to Mike. I think the real negative impact of his work, I think, is on the shadow he cast on other artists working in this arena. We've worked with many people over the years. And the reason why it didn't come up in the rehearsal process with Mike is because we'd worked with so many people over so many years who would never consider doing what he did. So it wasn't really within our checklist, you know, of what to ask and how to move the piece forward. So I think he's, you know, been forced to fall on his sword a little bit, and he certainly incurred the wrath of Ira Glass and a whole host of journalists and artists, I think, who work in this field.
You know, I compare that to someone like Anna Deavere Smith, who made it clear these are their words.
Yeah.
Or Dale Orlandersmith,
yeah,
who makes it clear this is fiction.
Right, exactly.
When I walked into Mike Daisy, I got to see Cargo Cult, and it did occur to me that Cargo Cult seemed exaggerated. It did feel
sure
that way.
Sure.
But on the other hand, he presents it, all of it, as if it's true. And then to say, hey, I'm just exaggerating.
Well,
you're making
stuff
up.
I think Mike got a little caught up in his persona. You know, the irony of this is that because of actually the events that he described being true, he did catalyze a huge investigation of Apple's labor policy in Southeast Asia and had a tremendously positive effect on the reform of that. I mean, let's face it. The bottom line here is that, you know, there were these horrific labor practices that Apple was supporting that Mike called attention to. On that level, the show was a fantastic and resounding success. And then we get into, okay, does the end justify the means? No, but I have to say it's a really unfortunate no. His intentions were good. The issues that he was rallying around demanded to be brought into the light of day. So that's good, but yeah, I mean, he screwed up. I mean, he screwed up to the extent where, I have to say this, we asked him, in our program from that show, he said, do you consider yourself a journalist? And the answer was yes. So that's more than unfortunate.
Tony Taccone, let's talk a little about the previous season. Rita Moreno and Ghostlight, I thought were stunning. Both of them were stunning shows. For Ghostlight, is there going to be a future to the show?
I don't know the answer to that. I would love to say yes. I mean, I'm very attached to the show, obviously, and there have been theaters that have expressed interest in it. I think the hesitation on the part of people who are interested is whether or not they think of it as just a Bay Area play. Ironically, I felt that the play played better, a little bit more lighter in Ashland than it did here, because not all the audience was from the Bay Area up in Ashland, and I felt like they were looking at it more freely as a play, as an artistic event, as opposed to the repository of all their memories of George Moscone, which here was really intense. I have to say, the theater, the air was thick, and so I felt it was thick with both wonderful and intentionally fervent feelings, but I also felt that people's desire, in some instances, were so strong they wanted to see this or that, and the play was either like a disappointment or a success for them based upon whether or not what they wanted to happen. So that was complicated. Rita, we've gotten probably 15 offers to move the show. I mean, everybody wants that show. But Rita's in a TV show. She's a featured performer in a show that's on a TV Land, which is a cable station. Happily divorced, I think is what it's called. Anyway, she can't get out of her contract with enough time to actually do it, so she's dying to do the show again. We'd love to have another crack at it because it's a fun show.
One other show that a lot of people absolutely loved was something called The Wild Bride.
Yeah, that was, I would say, across the board, that was a sort of a big hit for us. The Wild Bride was the creation of Emma Rice and her company from England called Knee High, which is really a tremendously creative group of folks. They use many different aspects of artistic creation, from dance to singing to acting. They create these kind of sort of wondrous fairy tales using this, like I said, the sort of multi-pronged toolkit that they have. And it was ended up being a kind of joyous event for the audience. It felt like it was celebratory just of life and its journey, but also celebration of the imagination, because I think the audience was in awe of them.
The talent of the performers came up continually, singing, dancing, all kinds of.
Yeah, and the fact that she married a Grimm's fairy tale with a blues score. I mean, that is just, it's wacky, but it was also informed by the fact that her father, this is Emma Rice now, who was the director and the principal auteur, her father loved the blues. Hmm. So she grew up listening to fairy tales while her father's records were in the background, and so the marriage for her felt easy, and for us it felt like a wonderful surprise.
How to Write a New Book for the Bible was, I guess, the new play of the season. Had that been performed elsewhere?
Well, actually, there were a bunch of new plays. Rita was new. Yeah. Ghostlight was new. Wild Bride was brand new. I mean, it had been done in England, but it was new here. So Bible was a wonderful play. It was a description of a woman who was dying of cancer and the caretaking that her sons provided for her, which sounds like a total bummer of a story, but it was done with amazing humor and warmth and love. The interesting thing about that play is that there was really no traditional dramatic conflict. Like, usually families are at war with each other on stage, and you kind of watch people kind of tear at each other, and then there's a denouement or a catharsis, and something gets revealed, or there's a family secret, and there's an arc to the thing. This play, the central character walks out and says, I'm from a normal family. who loved each other. And then from there, it unfolds where you're kind of watching this woman. The performance was astonishing. Linda Gehringer was astonishing in the role. The effort of the son and the mother to kind of come to terms with her condition and caretaking and the stress that put on them, but also the way that they chose to invent a language to take care of each other, what they said and did not say. It was really, really beautifully done.
And then, of course, there was Doctor in Spite of Himself.
The madcap show of the season. I mean, you know, there's a portion of our audience that actually, it's a small portion, but they're committed to telling me that they exist, who doesn't like slapstick. They feel like low comedy is aptly named, and they just don't appreciate it. I thought that was a show of genius. I mean, it featured Steve Epp, who many of our audience members have seen him because he's been here before. He played the lead in The Miser. He played the lead in Figaro. He's from a theater company in Minneapolis, formerly called June Loom, which no longer exists, actually. But he, in my estimation, is one of the great comic actors in this country. It was his adaptation, along with Christopher Bayes. And these guys have worked together for 25 years, and you can tell in the rat-a-tat-tat exchanges, in the inspired lunacy. But, you know, the audience members don't always understand, you know, that kind of work takes just as much vigilance and discipline and concentration that high tragedy does. There's a speech that Steve gave, and that he plays this doctor, Scannarell. He's made into a doctor and appointed the great expert, the great medical expert to heal this ailment that this young woman has. He gives a speech about his medical practice, his medical expertise, probably a 3-minute long speech, which is full of the most insanely irrational, lunatic logic you could ever imagine. It took those guys 2.5 years to perfect that speech. 2.5 years to just understand where it was going, what it was, you know, how long it could go, what it had to include, not include. I mean, just amazing. Amazing attention to detail and craft and to the rules. And there are hard rules of comedy. You hated that show?
You know, it reminded me of a couple of things I'd seen over at ACT of a similar sort. Yeah.
Did you see the Bill Irwin's Escapan?
Yeah, Escapan. And it's the same.
You didn't like it?
No.
Yeah, okay, so that's not your thing.
No.
You know, that logic. It's so funny because, you know, of all the forms of art that we presented, slapstick, that kind of comedy, is the most controversial. An actor like Jeff Hoyle, who I absolutely adore, is probably one of the most controversial performers ever to grace our stage because people feel like, oh, he's just making faces, or he's just like, you know, making, you know, doing funny walks. I don't agree at all. I just think he's an inspired performer, and that's a particular kind of clown work, what you call mask work, which those actors spend many years trying to perfect. But for me, it's very effective. I find myself rolling on the ground laughing, where other people are like, oh, please, you're boring me. Our audience is, for the most part, highly educated, which actually creates appetite for thought. You know, the thing about education is that it's trying to get you to think. One of the great attributes of our audience is that they can think in metaphor. You know, the shows don't have to be just about them. And I think that that's an astonishing advantage we have here in Berkeley, that we can present work like that. And people have a real eagerness to see it and to participate and to think their way through it.
There's one more show, which is in Paris, which I didn't see, but they just rented the studio? Or?
No. Well, I was in a subway stop in New York about a year and a half ago, and I was talking to an agent who represents certain people. And I said, well, what are the shows that you're currently watching or, you know, that you're going to represent? And he sort of rattled off a few shows, and Baryshnikov sort of popped out of this little speech of his. And I was like, wait. What did you say? And he said, well, there's this piece called In Paris, based on a Russian short story that's been adapted by an experimental Russian theater director of great renown, who's an old friend of Mr. B there. And I was like, well, listen, is that available? Because, look, Baryshnikov is one of the really, truly outstanding, superb artists who's ever graced the planet in the last 40 years. And so I was interested in anything that he might be a part of. So they sent me the material. And clearly it was an experimental piece. I mean, clearly you could tell right from the beginnings of the script and the little video that I saw that they were trying to create a vocabulary that was not driven by language entirely. The short story was very, very short, as it turns out. And they were trying to actually create more of an environment into which they could capture what ends up being the story of an Asian general who falls in love with a young waitress at a hotel, really. And what happens in the silence is far more important in the story than what happens in the words. And so you needed somebody like him. Of course, the real revelation in the show was the girl. The actress who played the role was fantastic. I mean, just his equal. But I have to say, you know, when he steps out on that stage, the word charisma is no more relevant than when he shows up. And he's also, the wonderful thing for us is that, for me, is that, one, he turns out to be a great guy, which isn't always the case. I mean, a star like that, who really has the world at his feet, you know, there's a lot of ways that they can go, and is a great guy. Also, he is committed to what I would call just the flat-out weirdness of art. He accepts the fact that art is going to traffic in the unknown. There are going to be things that make people uncomfortable. There are events on stage that are basically inexplicable, and that's part of the nature of the unconscious. It's the nature of art. So to be around a guy like that who is that comfortable, you know, in that arena with creating work that is not easily accessible entirely was really thrilling and validating. It was validating for everybody on our staff, I know. I thought the audience was going to be much more upset with the piece than they actually were. I mean, there were some people who were like, I've been coming here for 30 years. And, you know, it was definitely that. But actually, most people were more than respectful of the piece. They loved seeing him. They were aware that they were watching an artist who was a person of enormous stature and skill. And they were intrigued by the piece. And many people were taken with it.
Tony Taccone, the coming season, Chinglish by David Henry Hwang, like Red, came from Broadway, and now you're able to put it on here.
I read the play before it was ever done. David sent us the play, and I just thought it was, first of all, spectacularly funny. I mean, it's really spectacularly funny. You know, it has to do with the difference between translation. Anybody who's listening to this, who's visited, like, for example, my girlfriend and I, we visited Vietnam a number of years ago and went to the museum in Hanoi, and the descriptions in English of what we're watching were hysterical. I mean, absolutely. I mean, and you're thinking, they couldn't find anybody who spoke decent English to translate this stuff? I mean, it was amazing. And so the play traffics in just that. It takes place in China, and most of the play is enhanced with subtitles. So you're seeing people talk, and then you're seeing what they meant to say versus what's actually said, and it is really funny. It's also David. And so David's not just interested in ha-ha, cheap laughs. He's trying to pursue... Actually, there's a much, you know, larger method to his madness. He's trying to get after the cultural gap. That's really at the heart of the play.
When it says co-production with South Coast Repertory, does that mean that the same cast played down there?
It's going to start here, and it's going to go to South Coast Rep, and then from there it's going to go to a festival in Hong Kong, which David is, and we're like over the moon about that, because we've never had a show go to Asia, and some of his plays have been there, but this is the first time in quite a while that's happening.
Unlike that play, the rest of the season is varied and sometimes strange. You have a version of the Iliad adapted by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare, who's from True Blood.
You know, it's funny about that, you know, because Dennis O'Hare is a great actor. He's been a great stage actor for many, many years, and now he's like, he's True Blood, he's a vampire. I mean, he's a wonderful actor. I mean, the story that they've taken, they've actually taken part of the Iliad, which Robert Fagel did a brilliant translation of, and they've taken like a portion of it. The conceit that they've come up with is that Homer comes back to us now. The setting is the stage now, and he comes back. He's kind of a guy in a trench coat, and he's a bit of a, you get the sense that he's kind of like a bit of a barfly.
Is it a one-man show?
It's a one-person show, but it's a coming up with a cellist. Henry Warnitz, who used to be the artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, who's a brilliant actor, is going to be doing Homer, and he is an astonishing actor. It is a great piece of work. I saw it in New York with Steven Spinella. It's very moving and really grapples with war. And a long-term war that seems like it's never going to end. Gee, I wonder what that reminds me of.
The White Snake, adapted and directed by Mary Zimmerman. She did Arabian Nights, right?
Mary Zimmerman, this will be the seventh show of hers that we've done. Metamorphosis, Arabian Nights, as you just said. Argonautica, Secret in the Wings, Notebooks of Leonardo. We've done a lot of her work. I think Mary has created her own style of storytelling. I think she's one of the few people I've ever met who believes in theater as an act of healing. Her work is insatiably beautiful. I mean, this woman has a beauty quotient that 10 people normally have. I mean, the show is amazing to look at, amazing to watch. It's got a heart at the center of it that is beating robustly. And Mary's become a recognizable artist here, which I'm very proud of. It's perfect for us because it's going to happen at Christmas. It's a family show. I mean, it really is a family show. And not just for young. It's truly a family show. I mean, when we did The Composer is Dead, the one mistake I think I made with that show is that it should have been a special event because it was really for younger people. And I think it was advertised more as, you know, fun for everybody, which I thought it was. But I think this show in particular really is a family show.
Falaci by Lawrence Wright is about Oriana Falaci.
It is. It's a fictional play. Larry Wright, who wrote the play, won the Pulitzer for journalism. So this guy knows what he's talking about. He knew her. Falaci was a very, very famous journalist who was raised by an ardent communist. Her father was a lefty of the First Order, and she was clearly identified with the left for many years. She was most famous because she was fiercely smart, brash, hugely brave. And so she got interviews with people that very few other people ever got. She kind of became this legend in her own time, became older, became less well-known. After 9/11, wrote a very, very famous and scandalous book condemning Islam, all of Islam, became a darling of the right. So the premise of this play is that a young reporter hired by the New York Times to write her obituary, which is a common practice, goes to her in her dying days to get the obit. The first interview happens before this infamous book championed by the right comes out. So this reporter, who is a progressive young woman, goes to Falaci with a kind of, you know, adulation that a disciple or a follower, you know, would have, and is disarmed by her personality because it is so fierce. Falaci lives longer than expected. The book comes out, so so the young woman revisits her after her views about Falaci have changed. And what happens in the course of that relationship is the material, like, of the play. It's pretty spicy.
So that's Act One, Act Two.
Act One, Act Two, exactly.
And Pericles, Prince of Tyre.
Yes, by that unknown guy named Will Shakespeare.
Yeah.
The thing is that we're bringing Mark McDavey back. Mark McDavey is also, like Mary Zimmerman, he's done a number of plays for us, which have been seminally important to our development. He did Galileo. He did 36 Views. He did Mad Forest. I mean, Mark's done great, great work for us. Mark has his own version of Pericles that he's got. It's for 9 people, a couple of musicians. He's the role of Gower, normally played by a man, being played by a woman. Mark is one of the most imaginative guys I know. He brings a kind of restlessness and a kind of surprise to everything he does. And I don't think our history of producing Shakespeare is very strong. I don't think we've done it all that well. So I'm looking for Mark to kind of reverse that trend.
And then there's Dear Elizabeth, about the letters, I guess, between Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell from Sarah Rule.
Sarah Rule, who many people have come to know and love because of In the Next Room, which is the most recent play of hers that we've done, but we also did Eurydice. I mean, and Les Waters and Sarah have a very special kind of a relationship. So he's working with her on that. Yale commissioned this. Yale rep was the commissioner of this. And Sarah started to read these voluminous letters. And they're all the real letters that were written back and forth over a 25-year period between these two great, great poets and friends. The relationship was complicated, and the letters become this sort of testament to both the relationship and the culture in which these two great artists live.
Troublemaker by Don LeFranc is a world premiere, and it has to do with something called the ground floor, which is the Center for Creation and Development of New Work from Berkeley Rep, which is on your Harrison Street, West Berkeley campus.
Right.
Did this particular play come out of that, or is he just going to be a featured artist there?
He's just going to be a featured artist there because we received that play about a year and a half ago, and the ground floor was born about a year ago. And the ground floor, for those people who, you know, trying to figure out what it is, it's kind of like the research and development wing of a hospital, the plant where we incubate, nurture, and seed and develop new work. Its biggest overt feature is it has a summer residency, a component to it. This summer is the first summer of the ground floor. We have 13 new plays. I mean, it's really, really, really exciting. We have a wide range of projects coming in from something called the Food Project, which is where we're inviting 20 writers from around the world to come and write short plays about food, which is going to be presented in a major day-long, night-long event in between which the audience will actually eat meals with each other. So there's that, too. Five playwrights who are coming just to write their plays in a single room with a dramaturg, to the development of a musical, to, I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of shows that are coming to at various different stages of the development process, and we'll see what happens. It's going to be really, really exciting.
What chance does anybody have to see any or all?
A very good chance. One of the components that we're trying to work into the ground floor as a regular feature is the ability of audience members to actually engage with the work at various steps of the process. So one of the questions we asked every applicant, we put out this application form very quickly after we got the grants that were seeding this program last summer. We had a quick application process that lasted a month, and we got like 250 applicants basically. One of the questions we asked was, how do you feel about audience participation or engagement in your work as a seminal feature of your project? Virtually half the people said it was really important to them.
Would it probably be free then for people?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, free. We're not going to be charging any.
And people would find out about it online.
Yeah, I think what happens is that it's not going to be a free-for-all. Most of the projects are going to have some sort of a public presentation, some sort of moment where the public can kind of come and check out what's going on. Most people have no idea about the process, and of course after they see it, it tends to make sense. But you know, there's many aspects of the process of what we do. One of the things is the attention to detail, the repetition of certain events, and then you can watch something come to life with actors in front of a music stand. You know, somebody's just reading something at like a music stand, and you can feel like, oh my God, this actor is bringing this whole thing to life right in front of me. I think it's going to be interesting to see which pieces demand and need audience involvement more than others. I mean, obviously, the most obvious thing is that I think people working on comedies are going to really thrive on this because, you know, you want to know where the laughs are and if there are the laughs.
Tony Taccone, the next piece of Berkeley Rep is Emotional Creatures, Eve Ensler, coming in mid-June and extending into mid-July, correct?
Right. Based on Eve's book entitled I Am an Emotional Creature, it's really a testimony to the inner life of young girls around the world. Eve is certainly a person of the world, a major life force in the universe. Anybody who's met her knows exactly what I'm talking about. She is just irrepressible, man. You cannot stop this woman. And for all the right reasons. I mean, she has a passion for not just life, but for justice. And so I think she's giving an opportunity and some real stage time for girls to basically express what's going on in both a lot of music, a lot of songs, scenes, and Joe Bonney, who's the director, is kind of a master of creating event, and I think it's going to really be chock full of amazing energy and smarts.
And there's going to be a lot of free tickets given out for free
yeah,
tickets,
yeah, we have this great program where we can give, I think we're giving away up to, I mean, I think I'm right with this, like 3,000 tickets to girls around the Bay Area who wouldn't otherwise be able to get in.
Berkeley Rep has a school of theater at the Arpeggio building on Center Street. This is new?
We still have our school, which is on Addison Street, but we now have access to three studios in the Arpeggio building, which is on Center Street. If you're walking on Center Street near the BART station, you'll see the Artist's Alleyway, or the Artist Passageway, I think is what it's called, right next to the Wells Fargo building down the street there. And it's a new opportunity for us because there's just more places downtown for people to engage with theater. We're actually making the space available to a lot of local groups who are doing all kinds of stuff. And, you know, hey, more fun all the time.
Tony Taccone, there was Ghostlight, and you worked very hard on that for several years. Are you working on any of the plays now?
I am. This will become a shock to you, but Dan Hoyle and I have just written a play together using baseball as a backdrop for a play about really gambling on everything from games to the planet. It's a comedy. Dan and I are both really excited about it, and we hope to have a reading of it really soon.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, the artistic director of Berkeley Rep, currently at Berkeley Rep, Black and Blue Boys, Broken Men, One Woman Show with Dale Orlander Smith through June 24th. And then I think starting June 15th and extending into mid-July, Emotional Creatures with Eve Ensler. For more information, you can go to berkeleyrep.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.